Dr. Nomi Prenz, how are you?
I'm great. Thank you so much for having me on.
Thank you for coming on. I've been such a huge fan for a while, so it's great to finally meet you in person. I really wanted to ask you, everything is going on right now economically. Where exactly are we at? And that's such a tricky question. And I've had a lot of people at the conference here just really ask, they say, talk to Nomi Prenz about where we're at. So give me the 30,000 foot view here.
Sure, and it's a great question because there is so much going on. I mean, right now we're at a major intersection, I call pulse of geopolitics, energy transformation, economic searching for more efficiencies, competition for commodities. There's a lot going on in the world in terms of underlying impacts of those elements. But also from an economic standpoint on that 30,000, 40,000 level, here's what we know. We know that inflation continues to exist, which means central banks continue to talk about it. But we also know, and this is something I discuss a lot, that central banks can't actually control it. So in a way, that's kind of an elusive mirage of power that they are trying to sort of suggest that they have, but they really don't. And what we've seen because of that, net of the Fed, which I think will move soon, is that central banks around the world have kind of given up the goat of trying to fight inflation, and they have started to reduce rates. Canada did, Bank of Canada did, the ECB did, other banks around the world. So we're going to see the cost of money that had been jacked up a little bit come down throughout the world, and the Fed will follow that. And that's because of two things. One is that growth is also slowing. So even though inflation has slowed, it's still increasing, but growth is slowing by more than inflation is increasing. What does that mean? It means we're kind of in a recessed situation. The GDP of the United States last quarter was 1.3%. If you adjust that for inflation, that's effectively negative economic growth. And that is in line, actually, with what had happened pre-COVID. So we're really back to a kind of anemic economic growth platform, even though inflation is still rising, just more slowly than it has in the past. We had a blip of high economic growth after COVID because everything was closed, and now we're just not. So there's this need to really secure other forms of economic growth, and there's going to be a gap between knowing that and actually doing something about it. And I think into that gap is real assets that actually can engineer energy transformation and that fit into geopolitical competition, such as copper, such as uranium, such as rare earth elements, are going to play a greater and more pivotal role in the global economy.
Right. So in your book, you talked about how we're pretty much managed by these central banks, if you will, and they're all working in collusion with each other. How is that going to work, I guess, when you're having competition, if you would, for money from some banks, if you would, like, how is Japan, the Bank of Japan, going to raise rates, I guess, or not raise rates, or, all of that. How is that working with the collusion with all the central banks?
Yeah, so when I wrote collusion, it was in the wake of a massive move to 0% interest rates.
Right.
And a massive increase in something called quantitative easing, or basically, you know, printing money, electronically creating money to buy debt or to buy the bonds of each country. So the Fed, for example, put rates down at zero after the 2008 crisis. And the collusion was that everywhere around the world, in order to have global liquidity in the private banking system. So there's central banks up here, there's the banks here, and they work together to make sure that these big banks all around the world, the United States, Switzerland, Germany, and so forth, have enough liquidity, enough money to do what they need to do from in the private markets. And that was what was happening after collusion. That started to break down right before COVID. In 2019, central banks sort of started to get away from colluding together and a little bit more concentrating on their own economies. Still having the reserve currency of dollars be the prevalent currency, which it still is, but a little bit less, diversifying their reserves and so forth around the world. After COVID, we had another bout of collusion. Central banks dropped their rates again. They started printing money again. They started growing their book of assets again. The Fed's book went from $4 trillion up to as high as almost $9 trillion. Now it's down at $7.5 trillion. So all of these things happen. But what we're seeing now is a kind of fragmentation of that collusion. We now see, for example, China buying more gold, India buying more gold, Turkey buying more gold. We're seeing more competition from the more developing and large emerging nation central banks doing their own thing and trying to diversify their own ways of regulating the cost of money relative to the Fed and the G7. So it's a very interesting time where, because of that, the power of central banks is actually diminishing.
I'm glad you said that. Yes, it is. So talk about that. It's actually diminishing. Why?
Yeah, so I mean, I actually went so far in my talk at the Rick Rule conference, and I actually discussed this in some of my pieces now on print sites, in saying that Federal Reserve and other central banks are actually becoming irrelevant. Now, I have been watching the power of central banks from inside the financial system, from, you know, being a young analyst at Chase Manhattan Bank to a strategist at Lehman Brothers working on selling treasury bonds around the world, you know, China, Malaysia, Europe, the whole thing, to writing books about it, and to recognizing that they were so powerful because they controlled the cost of money globally. Mm-hmm. And working together made that even a more powerful situation. But now, this whole inflation period has made me, and I think anyone who studies the numbers, recognize that the Fed and other central banks can't actually control supply chains. They can't actually control geopolitical events. And they can't actually control the amount of time it takes to mine something from the ground into your iPhone, right? So they have this inability to really do what they say they are trying to do. Whether the Fed drops rates from 5.5% down to even 4% over the next year, year and a half, to combat growth slowing down or whatever it is they might think they can do, the reality is that is not going to change any of those parameters. And so we're in more of a phase now, I call it the real asset big bang, where assets, where underlying supply chains, where physical things actually are powering economies way more than central banks. And that, by just expansion, means that central banks and their power is becoming less relevant or irrelevant.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I really like that you put up this, you talked about supply chains, as they can't control supply chains. There's only so much oil,
yep.
If you would. There's only so much lithium. There's so much cobalt or base metals or precious
right.
metals or whatever have you. So we're at the Rule Symposium. There's a lot of companies here. There's a lot of hard assets. This is really a hard asset conference. Is there anything in particular, any companies that you are specifically interested in or that are interesting to you? Is there any also jurisdictions that you're interested in? Go ahead.
Yeah, it's a good question. Honestly, there are so many great companies here. And I think more than the specifics, there are companies that are doing things in this arena of geopolitics and supply chains becoming more prevalent in driving economies, in competition, in energy transformation. For example, UEC had a luncheon yesterday, and the uranium producers of America, of which they're a component, have been sort of waiting on the sidelines for the United States government and other governments around the world, particularly the United States, to pass legislation to enable more domestic supply for nuclear energy. So what I look at are the companies that are connected to these policies in areas, in assets that are going to be required and that are also being rubber stamped by governments around the world. I'm, as you know, on the board of a company now called Meteoric Resources, which is a rare earth element company with a large project out in Brazil called Caldera, which is about 3 hours outside of Sao Paulo in a place called Poços de Caldas. And one of the reasons that I'm attracted to that element, that company, and being a part of that, is because rare earth elements are sort of that hidden uptrend that is going to have to emerge for nations that want to secure their own domestic supply chain. Right now, China controls 60% of the rare earth elements. Rare earth elements are in your iPhone, they're in your computer, they're in LED lights, they're in missile defense systems. They're actually used in everything that is required by national security and by the economy, by technology advances. And so I think that's going to be a really important growing part of the market as well, and it's going to be important for the United States to secure supply there. Not only is China have 60% of the supply, they actually process 90% of the usable supply. And that's something that the United States and allied countries are going to have to basically come to terms with in order to be able to control prices, their own economies, and their own national security strategies.
Yeah, control inflation.
Well, and it does. I mean, it really does. You bring up a really good point, because for uranium, for rare earths, what happens is if you have certain countries that have the lock on supply, mm-hmm. For example, Russia and Kazakhstan have a lock on about 40%, 50% of the supply we have gotten in uranium. There was just an act passed by the United States Congress, signed into law, that bans the import of uranium from Russia. Now, if you're going to ban that, you need to replace it with something. So that's where UEC or other Canadian, you know, Cameco, all these companies come into play, because they actually are sourcing that supply to replace the supply that was coming from there. But what happens when you don't do that, whether it's Russian uranium or China and rare earths, they have the ability to control the market. That is inflation. Mm-hmm. If you spread the supply, you basically reduce the ability of any one country or group of countries that could control the supply otherwise to jack up prices. And so this is also what we're seeing with commodity wars around the world.
Yeah. So let's talk real quick about, you're one of the busiest people that I follow. You have some new projects that are coming out. Tell us about your new projects that are coming out, a new Substack. Go ahead.
Yeah, so I just launched literally a week and a half ago, July 1st, a new Substack initiative and company called Printsights Global. And Printsights Substack will have regular weekly analysis on everything that we're talking about. We actually have a really good gold piece coming out this week, but basically on all these topics that connect that intersection, that pulse, I call it, between geopolitics, economic, and energy and technology strategy. And then we'll also have specific analysis, deep dives on companies, specific companies that I think are appropriate for investing in these different trends, interviews with their CEOs, and boots on the ground analysis of their mines. I mean, for example, before I even joined Meteoric, I was out there. I was out at the mine. I was touching their rocks, and so that was one of the ways that I get out there in the world to really also bring people with me through this Substack. So I'm really excited about it. It's going to be a great venture.
Well, I'm really excited to read and listen and learn from you. So I want to thank you so much. I will link to everything that Dr. Nomi Prinz has said. I'll put it all in the show notes, both on YouTube as well as on Apple and Spotify. Dr. Nomi Prinz, it's an absolute honor and pleasure to finally get to meet you and talk with you. And I can't wait to see you again and talk to you again in the near future.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.